his mouth, but at first could only stammer and splutter before he was eventually overcome with laughter. Tassia joined in. "I think I'll have to give up my title to you," he said admiringly, and sat down beside her on the fresh green grass. "Which one? Heartbreaker or unbelievable?" "I must stop worrying about things I've always done," he said, more to himself than to her. He lay back, head on his arm, looking at her. "You, my poor dear, have a lot of catching up to do. What with your husband being so much more interested in men than women." Her cheeriness faded away. "Yes," she said, close to tears, her chin starting to wobble. "Oh, it's awful, isn't it? Oh, the shame!" She hid her face in her hands. "Shame on me! The gods!" "Stop, stop," he interrupted her. "You were far too quick with the tears." She stopped sniffing immediately and looked up at him through her fingers. "Too quick?" "More of a transition needed there, or no one will be convinced." He pulled her hands away from her face and kissed her on the forehead. "Apart from that, my dear Tassia, you with your body and face of a temptress elf, I was quite impressed by your performance. You just need a little more practice." She laughed and rolled over on top of him, giving him a good view down her front. He liked what he saw. "One day the Curiosum will belong to me, and you'll be dancing to my tune," she threatened him jokingly. "No doubt about that. You've won Raymar over already, and you'll soon have all the others eating out of your hand. Even old Gazer." He nodded and pushed her off. She yelped, landing on her backside in one of the few puddles in the field. Rodario stood up. "Oh, I'm so sorry." "Come and get me out," she demanded. But that was when the idea for a storyline came to him. "Get yourself out, Tassia. I've got to go and write this down." He hurried over to the steps where he had paper, quill, and ink. "Inspiration doesn't stick around. You have to get things written down when the ideas come." The girl, swearing, clambered up and then came and stood by him, wringing the water out of her wet skirt over his head. "You should have some of this too."
"Not now, Tassia."
He really was working.
"I've had an idea for a comedy."
"Oh?" She sat down next to him.
"What's it about?"
She wiped the drops off his face. "About a man and a woman."
"How original."
He stopped writing to look at her. "Or rather, it's about you and me." Tassia looked interested.
"Sounds like a love story."
"Exactly, my blonde beauty. Our story will be the plot. A man, a girl married to a husband who prefers other men, an evil father, a sword fight, a relationship full of fire and passion, with wit
and some treasure,"
Tassia interrupted. Rodario's quill hurried over the paper.
"Good thinking, good thinking," he praised her.
"But where do we get the treasure from?" She smiled brightly.
"I could have stolen a fortune from the evil father of my man-loving one-time spouse," she contributed. It sank in.
"Oh, Tassia, no."
"Why not?"
she said with a bold smile.
"Tell me that bit isn't true."
"But it is." She took him by the hand, pulled him into his caravan, and lifted one of the floorboards. She took out a bundle and opened it up. Rodario knew perfectly well this was not a hiding place he had selected.
"Close the door," she said.
It was a necklace made of gold, and in the middle there was a splendid gemstone that glittered and sparkled in the light from the window. Tassia held it out.
"What do you say? Is that a treasure?"
"In the name of goodness," he breathed.
"Is that a diamond?"
He took the jewel carefully and looked at it from all angles.
"No, Nolik's father is too much of a miser for that, even though he is drowning in gold. It's an imitation cut from the finest rock crystal," Nolik said. Did he give you the necklace?
Yes,
Tassia grinned. But first he stole it from his father. He gave it to me to make up for how I was being treated. He won't even know it's missing.
Rodario disagreed. He thought the gold was very fine, and he knew that a crystal like that was of considerable value.
We ought to send it back, he said.
She took the jewel back.
Never!
She was adamant.
Anyway, we'll need it for the play. Why don't you write up the argument we've just had?
She ran her finger across his cheek.
Dearest, if Nolik's father hasn't sent his bullies after us by now, he's probably not going to. We're 300 miles away now, and nobody's tried to stop us. We've nothing to be afraid of.
He let himself be persuaded. Besides, he liked the idea of putting the necklace in his new drama.
In my play we shall be visited by evil villains, who try and steal the necklace.
He grinned at her, and planted a wild kiss on her mouth.
Oh, I can see it all!
He lifted his hand, painting in the air with dramatic gestures.
We are surrounded by villains, but we fight our way free, because the necklace, in reality, is far more than just a jewel.
He was getting carried away, his thoughts glowing and throwing off sparks.
Of course! The necklace is a key. The crystal opens, a secret grotto, and inside there's a chamber full of gold and diamonds.
A dreamy look came into his eyes, and he struck a heroic pose familiar from his stage appearances.
Tassia! I am a genius! Nobody can doubt it, not even the gods. And there will be a fantastic sword fight in the final scene. Me against 3. No, against 7 men.
But I'll be in that fight too, she said.
You'll have to give me fencing lessons.
Rodario gave a dirty laugh.
Which kind of sword fighting were you thinking of?
He bent over and stroked her hair.
This is going to be a huge success. It'll soar like a comet.
His exuberance faded suddenly as he remembered.
But we need Fergus. He's the only one who knows how to make all my ideas work.
Tassia wrapped the necklace back up and replaced it in the hiding place.
You're really worried, aren't you? She said,
surprised to note the seriousness so often lacking in the showman Rodario. He nodded.
I've been searching for 5 cycles, and I've never given up because I'm convinced my friend is still alive and in trouble,
he explained, pulling her down to sit beside him on the bed.
Not physical danger, but I fear for his mind. He lost his partner and his 2 children in the battle at Parista. He was so bitter that in his fury against every living thing, he just walked out, never said goodbye, or gave any idea where he was going.
She took his hand and pressed it in sympathy. Rodario gave an anguished smile.
I've been searching for him all this time, and when you told me you'd seen him, I felt hope blossom all of a sudden, you know, like poppies blooming in a cornfield. I'm going to turn Mifidinia upside down till someone tells me where he is.
You will find him, she said, stroking his hand affectionately. Rodario kissed her bare shoulder. He did not admit to her that he was also a little afraid of encountering his hitherto best friend. There was no way of knowing how Fergus would react. Tungdil had recounted a conversation, and the Fergus he had described was not the one Rodario recognized. Someone had once said that death changes the living too. Perhaps Fergus wouldn't want any more to do with him.
I'll find him, he echoed Tessia's thought. The gods know what else will happen.
A little while later, Rodario, dressed as befitted a self-proclaimed emperor of the acting profession, paraded through the streets of Mifidania with Tassia at his side. Or, rather, they walked unsteadily along the narrow wooden causeways and bridges between the houses, because the lakes of Weyen had spread all this way now.
They've turned the disaster to their advantage, Rodario said admiringly, as they travelled through his old territory, which had been razed to the ground by the orc hordes of the traitor Nodon. A city on stilts.
He pointed over to where a remnant of the wall could be seen above the waterline.
That's where Fergus and I and Tongdil and the other dwarves escaped through the gate when the city was attacked. He was beginning to remember more and more about those events. Come on, I'll show you where the old Curiosum used to be. They made their way through a labyrinth of alleyways that Rodario did not know at all. The town had little in common with the old Mithridania, because it was smaller and more maze-like now. More than once they ended up back where they had started, but eventually he thought he had found the place. Disappointment hit him. There was nothing left of the once imposing building, only a narrow house against whose walls the water was lapping gently. "There's nothing left," he said. "I'm sorry, Tassia." "Master Rodario!" called a voice behind him, and someone clapped him on the shoulder, nearly flooring him. Two strong arms swiveled him round. "It is! It is him! Ye gods, help poor Mithridania! The man's come back!" The actor looked into the broad visage of a strongly built man of roughly 50 cycles. He looked vaguely familiar. Thin shirt, dirty leather apron, forearms as thick as axe handles, short blonde ash-covered hair. Then he remembered. "Lambus!" he laughed. "My friend the smith, still alive? The orcs didn't finish me off. The waters didn't get me, so I'm still here," the man said merrily, and glanced at Tassia. "When will we ever see you without a pretty girl at your side?" he joked. "When he's dead," Tassia grinned, holding out her hand. "I'm Tassia, his wife. I'm an actress." Rodario looked extremely surprised and rolled his eyes, while she laughed. "We run the company together, the Curiosum."
"That's not strictly,"
he objected, not taking to the role he had been allocated, but he felt a sharp kick to his foot and fell silent.
"It's great to hear our famous, incredible Rodario has come back. Laughter is good for us. I'm sure we've all forgiven you the previous escapades. The cuckolds of Mithridania will have long forgotten the bedroom farces you played out at their expense."
He grinned widely.
"What a surprise to see you settled down. But with a woman like her, anyone would settle."
He pointed to a wine shop.
"Come on, both of you. I'll buy you a drink." "I can hardly believe it either. I must have been drunk when I said yes,"
Rodario answered, digging Tassia in the ribs and making her gasp. She got her own back by kicking him on the shin. Lambus noticed nothing. He led them into the inn, sat down at the first table he came to, and ordered a jug of wine and some water. "My broad-chested friend here," Rodario said as he introduced the smith, "used to make all the things we needed for the Curiosum. Swords, iron bars, metalwork, for all the contraptions and illusions that our props man thought up." Lambus nodded.
"Those were the days. That Fergus was a master. He'd come up with the most amazing effects. Where did he get those spectacular ideas? The gods know how many hours I spent at the forge cursing when things didn't work right first time."
They raised their glasses.
"Here's to the old days."
"The old days,"
Rodario chimed in. Tassia smiled. The smith downed his wine and looked up at his actor friend expectantly.
"So, what have you got for me this time? Has your magic props man had some new ideas? It's ages since I last saw him."
Rodario shook his head.
"He's not with the troop now. That's why I'm looking for him."
Lambus furrowed his brow.
"You don't say. So he's touring with a company of his own?
Why do you say that?"
"He was here. He had a child with him."
Rodario nearly jumped over the table in excitement.
"When? When? Lambus, tell me." "Half a cycle ago? Beginning of autumn."
"Go on," encouraged Rodario, pouring the smith more wine. "Tell me everything. Where his house is. What he's doing."
"He doesn't have a house. Well, not in Mithridania. He came by boat, a kind of barge affair."
Lambus thought hard.
"He was buying stores for the winter, butter and lard, and then sacks of corn. He asked me for the old metal moulds we'd use for the cogwheels for the shows."
His face grew more thoughtful still.
Because of all the food, I assumed it was for your troupe going into winter quarters on one of the islands to rehearse a new play.
I don't get it, said Rodario. Has he really taken on new actors?
Perhaps he'd had enough of you, said Lambus. Did you have a fight? But I can't imagine you two falling out.
Rodario did not feel like telling the whole story. Do you know which island it was? Lambus shrugged his shoulders.
I'm sorry. If you want to find him, it'll be a long stretch, since the big flood islands come and go. Every day there's something new on the waters.
Rodario sighed. At least he knew now that his friend was alive, but no more than that.
Did he tell you anything?
No, not really.
The smith was a little awkward.
That is, he wanted me to go with him for 4 dozen orbits, he admitted at last. He offered me 100 weyen crowns if I kept quiet about my work. I had to turn him down. I've got too many customers in the town. I can't afford to lose.
Lambus looked past Rodario and Tassia.
Is someone looking for you, do you think?
The couple froze, the same thought in their minds.
How many? What do they look like?
Asked Rodario without turning round. All he had on him was one pitiful dagger.
Lambus moved his head a little. 8. Tall. Big guys. I'd say they can carry heavy loads when they have to. Ordinary kind of clothes, but not from Weyern.
So much for that treasure no one was going to miss, Rodario hissed to Tassia.
He won't even notice the necklace is missing, he mocked in falsetto.
Who says it's got to be my fault? Perhaps it's just some local fellows whose wives you seduced and they're after your pocket knife, she retorted sharply, exaggerating a deep, boasting voice.
Roll up, ladies. I have the stamina. I am unbelievable.
No, my dear. These bruises are from Nolik's father.
Is this some new play you're rehearsing?
Asked Lambus enthusiastically. It sounds great.
Rodario turned to the smith.
Lambus, my good man, the men behind us are not kindly disposed. Would you be good enough?
He passed him a coin. The smith nodded.
Go out through the kitchen. I'll try to keep them occupied if they see you, Master Rodario.
The pair stood up slowly and went over to the landlord, who let them out through the back. But two more of the heavies were standing out there with cudgels in their hands.
There she is, called one of them.
He jumped at Tassia.
See? They are here because of you.
Rodario couldn't resist the snide remark. He kicked the man in the groin so that he collapsed in a moaning heap. Tassia skirted round him as he fell and grabbed his cudgel. Resolutely, she landed a great thud with it on the chin of the second bully, stunning him. He tottered backwards, and before he could get his balance, Rodario hit him over the head with a crate of rotten fruit. He sank down, motionless.
"We make a damn good team," he crowed.
He was about to kiss Tassia when the back door flew open and 4 new opponents tumbled through. The girl raised her club.
"Be off with you! That necklace belongs to me!"
"Let's get out of here!"
Rodario took her by the hand and pulled her after him. Together they raced around the corner, not stopping until they came to a landing stage. The path ended too abruptly for his liking. However, the boats that had been tied up together formed a rudimentary, if unstable, bridge to the other side.
"Follow me!"
Rodario jumped and, in danger of being thrown off, balanced on the boats that were bobbing on the water like a handful of walnut shells. He managed to reach the narrow footpath on the other side.
"What are you waiting for?"
"Quiet, you!"
Tassia made her way across after him. It was harder for her because he had already set the boats rocking. She ripped her skirt to give herself more freedom of movement. In the meantime, Rodario had taken hold of the rope from the last of the barges and pulled it taut till she was by his side. Then he gave the boat a shove out onto the water. The bullies, in hot pursuit, were faced with a gap to jump. 2 of them fell off into the ice-cold water. The 3rd was about to attempt a leap across. Then Tassia saw a shadow fall over her from behind. An older man in local Mephidanian attire stood in the doorway,
about to empty some slops into the canal. He saw Rodario on the deck.
You!
He lifted his bucket to strike.
This is the moment I've been waiting for, you damnable seducer. I'll feed your manhood to the fishes.
Girdlegard, Kingdom of Goragar, late spring, 6241st solar cycle. Tungdil was rocking back and forth, his head fit to burst. His brain throbbed and thumped, and seemed keen to escape by way of his ears, but his throat was as dry and dusty as if he had been eating sand for 3 long solar cycles. He groaned, opening heavy lids, and blinked in the bright light, catching sight of his fingertips hanging an arm's length away, and gravel and scree passing by just underneath them. There was a strong smell of pony, and he could hear the sounds of at least one other horse. If he put 2 and 2 together, he thought, he must be on a journey, against his will.
Where?
He croaked as he tried to sit up. This made him fall headfirst into the dust. His startled pony gave a leap to one side, and the pack mule that was following bellowed in panic.
Calm down, Boindil soothed. He won't hurt you. He's just fallen out of the saddle.
A concerned face showed itself over his own, a black beard tickling Tungdil's nose.
Are you awake, scholar?
Tungdil sat up and brushed the dirt from his breeches. He took a look around and saw trees, bushes and grass. It was not like this in the middle of the mountain.
Where am I?
He pulled himself up on the saddle and felt his head was ready to explode.
You're with me,
was the dwarf twin's roundabout answer.
I can see that.
He turned round and recognized the outline of the grey range in the distance. You could still see the stronghold if you knew it was there. The tower reached up to the sky like a torch made of stone.
What are we doing here? They've sent us on a mission. We're the High King's envoys to Alandor,
Ironheart finally admitted.
Why? Is this punishment for my behavior? Actually, it was only me he sent, Boindil said awkwardly. But I thought a scholar might come in useful with the sharp... with the elves.
He swung himself up into the saddle.
So I brought you along. Gandugard doesn't know I'm here. I left a message for him. Have you kidnapped me? No, by Rakus, I certainly haven't.
Ironheart was indignant.
I found you in your room, and when I asked you if you would like to keep me company, you said yes. Loud and clear?
Boindil laughed.
Seemed like a yes to me.
He indicated Tungdil should get back up.
To be honest, I thought it would do you good to have a change, see something new. Going to pay our respects to the Lord of the Elves is not that bad a job. And anyway, you two know each other already. It's probably a good thing if their prince sees a dwarf face that's familiar.
He explained quickly why they were heading for Alandor.
As soon as all the dwarf delegates are assembled, Gandogar will send for us. We shan't be missing anything. They need heroes like us.
Tungdil looked in silence at the far grey mountains, then at the road ahead.
Right, he said,
and got clumsily back into the saddle. The ponies trotted along next to each other, and Tungdil drank some water out of the leather bottle at his side and kept quiet. His head hurt too much for him to want conversation. Not till late afternoon did he come to life and start to think of what had been said back at the High King's court, and of what they had seen in the outer lands. He could not remember what Gandagar and the elves had said about the piles of orc bones, so he asked Ironheart, who looked at him in surprise.
Nothing at all. Eldra stopped me and wanted to know how many snout-faced orcs had fallen foul of the unknown beasts.
He made a face and tossed his black plait back over his shoulder.
Do you think the Thirdlings just ate them?
Tungdil saw an inn at the crossroads they were nearing. This had to mean a bed and a beer. At least one beer.
"We'll stop here," he decided. "Thirdlings wouldn't eat orc flesh any more than we would. Not even if they were starving."
"And what about the undergroundlings?"
"Boindil, what rubbish," said Tungdil in surprise. "No dwarf would ever do such a thing."
He thought of Jerun, the bodyguard of Maegar Andukai, himself sprung from the Evil One. He had nevertheless devoured the creatures of Samusin and Tion. Tungdil gave voice to his thoughts.
"We know there are more of them than merely Jerun. Think of the one the Avatars sent to kill Andukai. That would explain why the other monsters haven't attempted the North Pass," grinned Ironheart. "If a whole family of Jeruns had set up home in the Outer Lands by the Stone Gateway, then we've got nothing to worry about."
Tungdil nodded.
"Perfect for the Thirdlings, if it's them behind all this. They block the tunnels and dig passageways in secret right into our territory to send their machines through, while the likes of Jerun fend off the orcs and other monsters."
His friend stayed silent for a while.
"What do you think? Will the High King be sending an army to the Outer Lands to sniff out the Thirdlings?"
"In my view, Gandagar has no other choice," said Tungdil, reining his pony to a standstill outside the inn, which seemed to have extensive stabling.
Obviously, the crossroads was a popular place for travellers and merchants to get fresh horses. A boy came running up to lead away their animals.
"Good evening, Master Dwarves. May Vrakas be with you," he greeted them politely. "Fresh grass and oats for the ponies, and a good room for the night for yourselves?"
Boindil threw the boy a silver coin.
"Will that get you to see to the animals and give them the best of care?"
"Of course, Master Dwarf," the boy said happily. "I'll soon have their coats shining."
He led them off to stand under the shelter and got to work grooming. Tungdil and Boindil stepped into the inn, amazed at the souvenirs and trophies displayed on the walls. The landlord had hung up old orc and alfar weapons and a collection of animal teeth. Long nails through the eye sockets fastened the skulls of monsters to the wooden beams.
"Take a look at that," murmured Boindil, nodding toward the corner by the taproom bar.
A life-size stuffed orc was mounted on a stand, right arm lifted as if to strike. In its left hand was a shield that bore the words, "Gilspan killed me." In large letters on the armor stood the prices for the drinks on offer.
"Not always easy to understand, these humans and their sense of humor," remarked Tungdil, as he crossed the crowded taproom to sit at a table by the window where the setting sun shone through.
A wiry young man approached, wearing an apron and a smile that would have done the incredible Rodario proud.
"Welcome, Master Dwarves! Welcome to Gilspan's hunting lodge!"
Ironheart chuckled into his beard.
"So you, my fine linnet, are Gilspan?"
"I most certainly am, Master Dwarf," the young man retorted indignantly.
"How old were you when you say you killed that snout face? 4 or 5 cycles?
He gave a friendly laugh and pinched Gilspan's arm.
"Ha! Your muscles are good enough for tray carrying, but not for winning a fight, I'd wager. Do you find your orc lying dead on the battlefield?"
The first guests were turning round to see who it was, spoiling for a brawl by slighting mine host's valour.
"I stabbed him in the heart, Master Dwarf."
"In the heart, eh?"
Ironheart turned to look at the stuffed orc.
"And where does a greenskin keep its heart, then?"
Gilspan went red.
"Give it a rest, Boindil," interrupted Tungdil. "Bring us 2 strong beers, landlord. Some hearty stew, and 1/2 loaf to go with it."
He slid the coins over the counter, still smarting from the insult. Gilspan took the money and went off.
"If he were 1/2 the man he thinks he is, he'd have challenged me to a fight on the spot," muttered Ironheart.
He searched for his pipe, filled it, and lit it from a candle. Molten wax formed a small puddle on the table as he did so.
"He never killed that pig face. I stake my beard on it."
They were brought their drinks with bad grace. It might have been pure chance, but when Boendil's tankard was set down, beer slopped over and spilled into his lap. Gilspan gave a full smile and an apology and hurried off.
"Bring me a jug of brandy,"
Tungdil called out after him, lifting his tankard to his lips and emptying it in a single draught. He started on its successor greedily. The beer ran dark down his beard, staining it.
"How did it happen, scholar?"
Tungdil wiped his mouth and his beard.
"I was drinking too fast."
"I meant that you're tipping it down, as if that old drunkard Bavragor were your baby brother,"
Boendil insisted sharply.
"Tell me why you're like this now, and why Belindis mourns."
Tungdil was angry with himself for having let that slip out.
"Because of Balodil."
"Balodil?"
The dwarf twin leaned forward so slow toward his friend that his black beard was nearly in his tankard.
"And who is Balodil?"
"He's our son."
Tungdil took a mouthful of brandy.
"Was our son."
Boindil was careful not to say anything. Gradually, Tungdil's words and his recent behavior merged to form a distressing picture. Gilspan brought their food. Neither of them touched it, despite the delicious smell and despite their hunger after the long journey. The past must first be dealt with.
"He was born 4 cycles ago, and was the crowning of our love, the apple of our eye," whispered Tungdil from a place far away as he sat staring at the flicker of the candle flame. "I took him with me on an errand, and I'd promised Belindis I would look after him. But the wooden bridge I always used had been damaged in the flood."
He gulped down the brandy. His face was a single grimace of disgust.
"I am Tungdil Goldhand, victor over Nadon and Avatars, slaughterer of hundreds of orcs, and a scholar to boot. You'd think I could manage to cross a rickety bridge," he said caustically, looking his friend in the face. "That old bridge, Boindil, showed me who was stronger. It collapsed under the cart, and we were tipped into the river. My mail shirt pulled me down. I'd have drowned but for an empty barrel bobbing up under me."
The laughter and loud voices in the taproom behind them swallowed his words.
"So, now here I am, telling you about Balotil. How do you think the story goes for him?"
This time he did not even trouble to pour the brandy into his cup, but drank straight from the jug. He set it down, gasped for air, and belched.
"I never found his body, however long I searched. Since that day I've hated myself. Belindis can never forgive me, and I've taken to drink. I'm going to drink till it kills me."
He paused.
"No, I'm going to drink so it kills me. Should have drowned with my son instead of living on like this. So I'm drowning my sorrows and myself in drink."
Disgusted, he pushed away the plate of stew.
"Scholar, it was an accident. Rotten timber," objected Boindil, wanting to wrest away his guilt. "Rotten wood and the curse of the goddess Elria. It was the curse that struck you, dragging you, your son, and the cart to the bottom. It was not your fault." "That's what Belindis says, too."
He lowered his head.
"But I see that silent accusation in her eyes all the time. I fear our love went cold that very day. She thinks I don't notice her feelings. She tries to hide the hatred and disgust. It is so cold now back in our vaults, colder than ever before. The grief in my heart has robbed me of any desire to live."
He rubbed his face with both hands.
"So now you know why I've changed.
I'm off to bed, Boindil.
He got up, swaying, stumbled off to the stairs, and disappeared.
Ironheart wiped the tears away. He must help his friend and restore his love of life. There was only one way to do that.
Ruckus, have mercy, and send your blessing to Tungdil.
He glanced at Gilspan, expansively welcoming new arrivals and showing off the orc he had dispatched. Mine host was clapped heartily on the shoulder for his deeds of daring. Boindil got up and plodded up the stairs. He had to speak to Belindis. He simply could not believe she was harboring the feelings that Tungdil had described. The night was already far advanced. Gilspan was at the table entertaining the other guests with yet another story about how he had killed his orc.
And when the Toboribor hordes came through close to our farm, I took up my weapon to defend my house. My father was far away from home, but he'd left me his dagger. I'd sworn on it that I'd protect my mother and all the people in our land.
He laid the dagger on the table as evidence.
That was all you had?
Breathed a girl of 16 summers, travelling in the company of her parents and of her betrothed.
Yes, and the orcs were not stopping. They arrived in the evening, and a whole troop of them on the scavenge for provisions.
Gilspan sprang up.
I went up to their leader and challenged him to a duel. He had his sword, and I attacked him with my dagger.
Oh, you're so brave! The girl clapped her hands and was lost in admiration.
I thought the blood of Gerdlegard was supposed to render them immortal, objected her fiancé. It didn't help him, said Gilspan, waving his dagger in the air. I got everywhere, stabbing away and slitting at him, till I'd plunged the blade right into his heart, and he fell dead at my feet.
He posed with one foot on a chair.
The others fled, and the farm was saved. Because he died before the time of the Judgment Star, the cadaver has survived all this time.
The men gave him a round of applause. The women gave him some coins, and the girl gave him a small silken square embroidered with her monogram.
But how were you able to cut off its head with a dagger?
The jealous fiancé was not giving up.
A knife thrust to the heart was enough, sir.
The girl's betrothed looked over at the orc.
Excuse me, Gilspan, but the soldiers I've talked to always say you've got to cut the creature's heads off to properly do away with them.
It went very quiet. Everyone was staring at the stuffed creature posed in the corner with its bared fangs, a remarkably lifelike figure in the dim light.
Wasn't it standing a bit differently when we came in? Whispered the damsel fearfully, sliding nearer to Gilspan.
Her betrothed took her arm and pulled her back to his side.
Yes, you're right.
Her father went pale.
I swear by Palandiel he had his sword held upright before, not down in front of him. What's this? A horror story to frighten little children? I pulled his innards out through his doublet myself, said the landlord.
He went up to the creature. There was a loud creaking noise, and the upper torso of the orc turned in Gilspan's direction. The women screamed. The men drew their swords.
You idiot of a man! You've brought the evil one right into your own house!
Gilspan was completely bewildered. He wanted to reply, but the orc started making its way over, raising its sword arm and lunging at him. The man disappeared, screaming under the monster. He dropped his dagger, crawled out from beneath his attacker, slid under the nearest table, and cried for help like an old spinster. Upstairs, doors were opening, boots came clattering down the stairs, and lanterns were brought to give a better light. The orc lay motionless on the floor and laughed, and laughed, and laughed. As more and more lamps came on the scene, they saw it was not the monster, but a dwarf lying there, helpless with laughter. He got up and stood by the bar counter, slapping himself on the thigh. His laughter infected the room, not least because of the relief everyone felt, and then because of Gilspan, the hero, quivering underneath the table. Boindel had played a joke on them all and had made the monster come to life by groaning a bit, pushing it and rocking it where it stood.
"Now, my little linnet," he said, bending down to look under the table, "where is your bold courage now? Where did you get the orc?"
"I..." Gilspan was obviously thinking up a new lie.
"Think hard who you're trying to trick here,"
warned Ironheart, shaking a fist in his face.
"Bought it. I bought it 4 cycles ago," he admitted ruefully. "Like all the other stuff on the walls."
The guests laughed at him as he crawled out from his hiding place.
"Rotten, stinking dwarf. You've ruined everything."
"Me? It's you who've ruined everything by your cowardice. If you'd been the man you pretend to be and had launched yourself at your attacker, everyone would be admiring you."
Boindel nodded to the girl's fiancé.
"Well spotted. You do have to cut off their heads so that evil doesn't restore their powers."
He raised his crow's beak hammer and slung it through the creature's head, severing the dried vertebrae so that the skull was caught on the weapon's long spike.
"It'd be really dead now."
He smashed the bone on the counter, and fragments scattered far and wide.
"Best to be on the safe side," he grinned, shouldering his hammer.
The next day they continued their journey to Alandor. Tungdil had slept through the tumultuous doings of the night. He got up in the morning, woken by Boindel, and got ready for the journey in silence. Without stopping for breakfast, they set off in a southwesterly direction. The ponies trotted tirelessly on, following the road. They were surrounded by a richly varied landscape. It was still mountainous here, although a dwarf would call it hilly. Sometimes they rode along the side of a ravine, sometimes through wide valleys, and then again across uplands, from where they had a view over the wilder North Goregar. They saw no thick forests. For that, the soil was too poor. Ironheart, at the head of the column, had some food on the way. Tungdil had bought a bottle of brandy from the innkeeper. He continued where he had left off the previous evening. His friend looked back at him, shaking his head.
"Do you really think drinking makes it better? You could have learned a lesson from Babaragor."
Tungdil paid no attention and lifted the bottle once more to his cracked lips.
"That's enough! It's not going to bring Balodil back, scholar."
Boindil turned his pony round and rode back.
"Make use of your life and respect his memory instead of wallowing in self-pity and making a fool of yourself."
"No, it won't bring Balodil back," murmured Tungdil. "I told you, I'm drinking myself to death."
He belched, spat, and drank again.
"You want to die?"
Ironheart jumped down out of the saddle, grabbed the startled dwarf by the collar of his leather doublet under the mail shirt, and pulled him to the ground. He dragged him over to the edge of the precipice they were on.
"You really want to die?"
In a fury, he wrested the brandy bottle out of his grasp and hurled it down the cliff. After a long fall, it shattered, leaving a dark stain on the rock.
"Then go after it," he thundered. "Put an end to your miserable existence. Do it right now. But stop the self-pity. The lowliest of creatures has more dignity than you."
Tungdil could not escape from Boindil's steel-hard grip. Without mercy, the dwarf twin pressed his face down over the drop. A warm breath of wind came up from below, playing gently around his face as if inviting him to jump.
"Well, scholar," fumed Ironheart. "You say you want to die? Get on with it."
He grabbed the mail shirt and pulled with all his amazing strength. From somewhere deep inside, Tungdil's instinct to resist awoke. It was a boundless urge, knowing neither rhyme nor reason. There was nothing to live for, and yet still he held back and refused to take his place in the eternal smithy, if indeed there was a place for him there. He grasped the stunted grass, scraping his fingertips open on the stone. The pain cleared his alcohol-befuddled head.
"Let go!"
yelled Boindil in his ear. I'm making it easy for you, and stopping you from wasting yet more money on brandy and beer.
He gave Tungdil a mighty kick in the side. Tungdil cowered in pain, losing his grip. The top half of his body now lay over the cliff edge.
No, no, he called out in desperation. You!
I'll tell them you were protecting me from bandits,
Ironheart continued relentlessly. People will think of you as a hero who died in time to salvage the meager remains of his reputation.
Another kick met Tungdil's ribs. Yelling, he slid forward. Stones broke away, and he rolled down the steep slope, raising small clouds of dust on the way.
No!
Gathering the last of his strength, Tungdil pushed himself up off the ground, throwing his weight backwards. He hurled himself back, dragging Boindil with him, and together they fell onto safer ground.
I've changed my mind, he panted.
Oh, and where does this sudden change of heart come from?
Tungdil took a deep breath.
I can't say. There's a voice inside that won't let me.
A voice called fear?
Tungdil shrugged his shoulders.
No, no, it was something else. Life itself, I expect.
The voice of Rakkus,
replied Boindil, getting up and proffering his hand.
He will need you and your keen fire blade soon enough. New enemies are threatening your race. Perhaps it is your destiny to defeat them.
Tungdil let himself be helped up. Then he went over to the cliff edge and looked over. Only one small step, and his troubles would be gone. He raised his foot, and again he felt the inner barrier.
Still got a death wish, growled his friend.
No, answered Tungdil slowly. I wanted to be sure that I really want to live.
He turned away from the edge. Ironheart held out the reins of his pony to him, and Tungdil took them.
That is what you want. I would have pushed you over if you hadn't fought against me with all your strength.
His voice was earnest.
It's the only way to find out if someone really wants to die.
A crooked smile crossed his face.
Believe me, I've been through the same treatment as you.
You were in despair at the death of your brother.
Tungdil understood now, and watched the warrior climb back into the saddle.
Half of me died when he did. Perhaps it was the better half. The other half dissolved into pitiless grief until I was convinced I wanted to die. Someone did to me what I just did to you, and that made me see. I preferred to be amongst the living rather than the dead. Fracas knows why.
Grinning, he pointed to the road ahead.
But sending us to the elves is taking it a bit far.
He spurred his pony onwards. Tungdil laughed quietly.
You're right. Rakkus knows why.
The shock of his salvation gave Tungdil now an extreme clarity of thought he had not known since before the death of his son. He had done everything wrong. For the past four cycles, he had done everything wrong. There was only one way out. He vowed to himself that he would return to Belindis as soon as he could and beg her forgiveness for everything. The bitter words, the constant drinking, the rejection whenever she had tried to touch him. He could not forgive himself. Deep in thought, he stroked his pony's soft muzzle. Ironheart was a few paces ahead.
Coming, scholar, he called. Or is the pony giving you some advice?
No,
Tungdil called back.
It's telling me I'm too fat.
You should have asked me. I could have told you that.
Tungdil took the pony by the reins and started to run.
You're a good friend, he said,
and it was not clear which of the two he meant. The exercise would not hurt him, and it was a good few miles still to Allendore. Time to lose a few pounds.
Chapter 4 Girdlegard, Queendom of Wayern, Mithridania, Late Spring, 6241st Solar Cycle.
"Mind out, Rodario!"
He heard Tassia's warning just in time. He ducked. The slops aimed at his back, missing him by inches and hitting the girl instead. She cried out and stumbled backwards into Mithridania's floodwaters, which washed the pale, stinking contents from her dress.
"That's good luck," grinned Rodario, punching an injured pursuer full in the face as he was trying to jump onto the walkway from one of the boats.
The thug landed in the water. Then the actor spun around, beaming.
"Master Umtaschen, you haven't forgotten me. Delighted to find you're still so lively."
"You foul seducer,"
shouted the older man, who had attacked so suddenly with a bucket.
"She was promised to the judge's son. He would have none of her with your bastard in her belly."
He swung the bucket again.
"I'll have your balls off for that."
"Master Umtaschen, it was your daughter who seduced me," retorted Rodario, fending off the pail. "And I wasn't the first, believe me, I'd have noticed."
He grabbed the bucket and hurled it at the last of the band of pursuers Nolik's father had sent after them. The man, who had been balancing precariously, debating his next move, was sent flying into the water to join Tassia and his comrade in thuggery.
"At least the others didn't make her pregnant," Umtaschen roared, swinging both fists.
"If that is the case, Master Umtaschen, I'll be happy to meet with her again and show her a good time. It seems I have your blessing, as long as I'm careful where I aim this time,"
laughed Rodario as he took a sudden step forward. Umtaschen sprang back out of range inside his house.
"We're not done yet,"
he threatened and disappeared as fast as he could when Rodario gave a warning stamp with his foot. Someone splashed him. He turned round. A girl's hand waved from below the edge of the landing stage.
"Help me up before the other two get me,"
Tassia called, and he hurried over to haul her out. As she stood in front of him, soaked to the skin, he could see how the water had made her dress transparent. The two who had been following them had given up and were swimming back to their three colleagues on the other side of the canal.
"What do we do now?"
asked Tassia, smoothing back her wet, fair hair. In Rodario's eyes, she was temptation itself.
"They're bound to have gone to the Curiosum."
"They didn't find the necklace there, so they think one of us has it," Rodario said and nodded. "Hey, you blockheads!"
he called out to the men, pretending to be holding something.
"You want the necklace? Think again. Tell Nolik's father we're going to sell it. He can come to Mithridania and buy it back."
One of the heavies was about to clamber onto the string of tethered boats, but Rodario moved up to the end of the landing stage.
"Stop right there. If anyone follows us, we'll chuck the necklace into one of the canals and you can go diving for it."
A gesture from his leader stopped the man in his tracks.
"Well done,"
the actor praised him, taking Tassia's hand and running off.
"Stay where you are,"
he warned and ran off round the corner with a laugh. When they were passing under an awning formed by garments drying on a washing line, Tassia stopped.
"Wait, give me a leg up."
Rodario did as she asked, and she placed one foot on his locked hands and wedged her other foot against the wall. Sprightly, as if on solid ground, she filched a dark yellow dress from the line and jumped down again. Without taking any note of her surroundings, she stripped off her wet clothing and slipped into the stolen garment. Then she gave Rodario a passionate kiss, laughed, and ran off.
"This wild creature will be the end of me, or the making of me," he grinned, hurrying after her.
Late in the afternoon, they finally arrived at the forge where Lambus worked. Rodario wanted to thank him and to get a few more details about where Fergus might be. The inner gate to the forge stood open.
A fire burned in the furnace, and two pieces of metal lay red-hot in the flames waiting to be worked on. They couldn't see the blacksmith.
"Lambus! You old iron basher!" called Rodario. "Are you here?"
He stepped into the half-light, but before his eyes could adapt to the dark, he tripped over something on the ground.
"What the?"
He bent down and saw what had nearly made him fall. A young man's outstretched legs. In the man's side there was a gaping hole. Blood had spread over the floor.
"Mind out, Tassia,"
he warned the girl, who was hot on his heels.
"There's been a murder.
Perhaps one of the heavies sent by Nolik's father." She peered over his shoulder and went pale. She stepped back, retching, then turned and fled for the door to get fresh air. Rodario studied the brutal wounds, the work of a very sharp axe.
"I don't think so. Those men didn't have weapons that could make injuries like these."
Rodario got up and went over to look at the iron objects in the furnace. One of them could indeed have been an axe head.
"Lambus!"
he called out, taking a poker and moving slowly into the dark recesses at the back of the forge. At that point, a figure jumped out of the shadows at him. With great presence of mind, Rodario stepped to one side, and a dagger just missed his throat.
"Assassin!"
he shouted, and took a wild swing with the poker, hitting the dark-clad attacker full in the face so he collapsed in a groaning heap. The knife clattered to the floor. To be on the safe side, he gave the man another blow with the poker, then grabbed him and dragged him over to the part of the outbuilding where there was better light.
"Let's see what we've got here."
He saw a dirty face marked with burns. The man was a good 50 cycles old and looked more like a simple workman than a professional killer. The poker blow had broken his nose and knocked out two of his teeth. There was blood coming out of his nostrils and his mouth. In a daze, he was trying to break away, but couldn't.
"Tassia, bring me a red-hot iron," Rodario requested. "We can pierce his tongue with it."
"No, let me go," he mumbled, terrified. "He'll kill them if I'm not back on time."
"Did you kill this man?"
Rodario picked up the glowing metal and held it in the man's face. His eyes widened in fear.
"Who sent you, and where is Lambus?"
The man was trembling like a fish on a hook.
"I don't know. Ilgard did it because the boy refused to come along and he threatened to betray us."
Each answer brought more questions in its wake.
"Get the story out, old man, or I swear by Samusin, I'll put out your eyes with this iron."
Rodario threatened the man again, putting on his most villainous expression, a face that went down well on stage. Not for a moment did he really intend to harm the old man any further.
"Are you a friend of the blacksmith?"
the man asked, coming to his senses.
"If so, by the grace of Palandiel, don't tell anyone what you've seen. Tell them Lambus is off on his travels. Get rid of the boy's body. That's the only way your friend will ever be able to come back."
"Is Fergus in the power of whoever's got Lambus?"
asked Rodario, guessing wildly.
"He's about my size, black hair, and..."
The man's face changed suddenly. He looked surprised.
"You know the Magister?"
"He's my best friend."
The man spat in his face.
"May all the demons..."
Rodario heard a faint swishing noise, one he knew well from his adventures outside the world of theatre. A jolt, and the man fell slack in his grip. An arrow shaft stuck out from the man's back. Death had been instantaneous.
"Get down, Tassia! Get under cover!"
called Rodario, going to one side to crouch down behind a heap of coal and wiping the bloody spittle out of his face. There had been many times in his life when things had happened beyond his understanding, but so far, this was the height of not understanding. Quiet steps could be heard approaching. Rodario could hear the creak of leather armor straps, and iron rings clanked. There was the sound of a sword being drawn. When he saw a boot next to him, he took hold of the tongs and dropped the red-hot metal down inside. There was a hissing. The man yelled fit to bust and ran out.